beautiful and interesting, too. The way those repetitions pile up one on top of each other. I'm trying to think of why someone would write like that. And one of the things that occurs to me first, if you're praying, you come to the last line of a prayer, it's entirely appropriate. Sometimes it's essential that you repeat that line. And then having said it again, and especially it goes off into a big space like this cathedral, which you before, and you want to hear it over and over again. That's the way it hit me. What was this we were listening to, Joe?
This is Nathaniel Dett, part of a lineage, you could say, beginning with Dvorak and his prophecy. Mm-hmm. And then comes Burley. Actually, then comes Coleridge Taylor, mm-hmm. even though we don't remember him. Even though he didn't clinch Dvorak's prophecy, he tried. Burley did in his own realm. And the next guy up, Nathaniel Dett, his dates are 1882 to 1943.
So he's about almost 20 years younger than Burley.
Exactly.
Coming after that in this forgotten story is Florence Price, William Grant Still, and William Dawson. So we're talking about black composers aspiring to be important composers in the white classical tradition, as was prophesied by Du Bois and Alain Locke and Dvorak. And unlike Burley, these are all composers who could orchestrate. Mm-hmm. And they all wrote for orchestra. And three of them wrote symphonies.
Florence Price wrote a piano concerto, which I've heard. I think she was the soloist, in fact.
She wrote four symphonies and a piano concerto. Mm-hmm. Dawson wrote one symphony. We're now, at this moment, discovering these composers. You may have read about Florence Price. She's in the news. Eventually, we'll get to Nathaniel Dett. There was a revival of his oratorio, The Ordering of Moses, by the Cincinnati Symphony that resulted in a recording in 2016. So we will do our own tribute to Nathaniel Dett with Kevin next season, but we've already sampled him.
Give me an idea. Where geographically on this continent were these composers?
I'll let Angel tell you about Dett, but before he does, you have already noticed Nathaniel Dett is not Harry Burley. What Burley does are arrangements of spirituals. This is not an arrangement of a spiritual. Mm. This is an original composition, 7 minutes long, that uses a tune, a song, that is of Dett's own creation.
You said, too, that we had discovered he had been listening to Eastern Orthodox Russian choirs in the period right before he was writing this piece.
We learned from Clipper Erickson,
yeah,
who has recorded all of Dett's piano music and knows much more than I do about Nathaniel Dett, that in his opinion, this work was inspired by Dett's exposure to Russian Orthodox liturgical chant.
Yep.
So, Ankel, tell us about Dett and what it's like to conduct Dett.
Well, Nathaniel Dett, he was fully educated in what we call Western art music. I mean, he went to Oberlin. He finished a five-year course there. He studied with Arthur Foote in Harvard. And it's very interesting that he studied with Nadia Boulanger in France. Mm-hmm. And I actually wonder about Boulanger's reaction, because Boulanger was famous for telling very inspired composers to stop studying with her. I don't know if you know that. She told Astor Piazzolla, for example, to just to leave Paris and don't learn anything more. You don't need anything more from me.
So Astor said he wanted to throw her out the window when she said that to him. True.
And then he got his master's degree too. But he fully somehow follows Burley's path. I mean, I have selected here something he said. We have this wonderful store of folk music, but this store will be of no value unless we utilize it. Mm-hmm. So he's referring to the spirituals, to the solo songs. Unless we treat it in such manner that it can be presented in choral form, in lyric and operatic works, in concertos and suites and salon music. So in the end, he's following the path of Burley. About the Oh Holy God, you know, at the beginning, it took me some time to understand the piece. Of course, it responds to what you pointed before, which was great, this antiphonal idea that this is very much part of the spirituals. And then what you said now about the repetition, of course, the words that he's saying, done with sin and sorrow, it's very dramatic. Mm-hmm. So probably it's part of this to really create even more drama, to repeat this four times. He repeats that four times in the song. And the ending is very, very beautiful. I think it's really an extraordinary piece.
I must say, I'm so ignorant. I don't even know if this is a piece that he's appropriating. Kevin, do you? Is this his own composition wholly? Or is there something that he's taking and elaborating?
I don't recognize that it has the quality of a spiritual that may have predated his composition.
I suspect that it's wholly his.
I have a question about a term that you used as opposed to what Angel said. You said white classical music, and Angel said Western classical music. I don't know. I'm not comfortable with the idea of white classical music. Mm-hmm. For one thing, I mean, the classical music tradition came from all parts, lots of different parts of Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, the Germans went to Italy to learn, and is that appropriation? The Germans went to Italy to learn how to write in that style, in the Venetian style. Handel went to London and taught them more about pomp than they knew in his great works. So
I'll tell you why I use that term. I use it tendentiously. It's because classical music in America stayed white, and it didn't have to. I feel as if barriers were erected. In fact, I more than feel, I know, that barriers were erected, and it prevented the fulfillment of Dvorak's prophecy. If you look at the people who tried to turn it black, whether it's Debt or Florence Price or William Dawson, who wrote an astounding symphony called the Negro Folk Symphony that went nowhere. If you look at Porgy and Bess, which was anathematized by white composers, and we were told by Virgil Thompson and Copland that Gershwin was a dilettante, this makes me pretty hot. I think that Dvorak was correct, that we could have had black classical music, and the fact that we didn't is why I use the term white classical music.
I don't ever want to get into a fight with a guy who uses a word like tendentious. Tendentious.
You can tell how quiet I am right now.
We've had this discussion before, Joe. Yeah. We really have. What Copland and what Virgil Thompson did, I'm not a great Virgil Thompson fan as a composer at all. He's a rather clever wordsmith. What Copland writes his words sometimes is helpful if it gets you close to the music. And the rest of it, you should just pay attention to the music, which you might like or might not like. It doesn't tell you what he thought about Gershwin as anything to have any connection with what I care about him.
But he did say what he thought about Gershwin, and he did say what he thought about jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And in both cases, he denigrated.
Yeah, and he was wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, but he also tried, like in the piano concerto, there's a whole lot of pretty hip jazz for 1923, 4, 5 in it. So he tried it. It didn't work for him.
This is an endless controversy between the two of us.
I know.
But anyway, Kevin, that's why I used the term white classical music.
Okay. But we're not going to do that much more. We don't need to do that. Your point is taken. We got it. And I think even to call it Western classical music anymore is a misnomer. Man, I was walking around in Shanghai by the conservatory, and in about a two-mile loop, I passed 12 piano shops. Yes. There are a kajillion kids in Asia appropriating our music. That doesn't make it white classical music,
no.
We can take it, or black classical music, or yellow classical music.
No.
It's just music.
That's right.
Sure. Just to beat this dead horse, if Gershwin hadn't died in his 30s, classical music in America would be less white.
Or more interesting and varied. I'll leave it at that.
Fine.
I don't think music has a color at all. I understand the way that culture was not willing to accept African Americans on their stage, and that there was definitely an agenda, and there might still remain one, in terms of the acceptability of African Americans on the classical stage. But I just feel that, for one thing, to call it white, I mean, is that you're saying white America.
I say being tendentious, which means I'm being consciously argumentative.
I know.
Oh.
In order to make a point
that
I feel
that's
passionate.
Totally different.
No,
that's
in the dictionary, next to that word, it's got a little picture of Joe.
Tendentious.
Yeah. I'm saying that to pick a fight.
Okay.
You got one.
You got one. But let's move on. We got more music there. Music which can bring us all together, I'm hoping.
Yes.
So let's talk more about Nathaniel Dent.
Nathaniel Dent was born in 1882 and died in 1943. So as you said, he's 16 years younger than Harry Burling.
Mm-hmm. Thank God for Wikipedia. I just discovered that Nathaniel Dent is not African-American. He was Afro-Canadian. was born just across the border, Niagara Falls, we call it today, and then moved to New York City when he was a youngster, 1890s, right?
So he was 11
yeah.
when he came to New York. And he has this remarkable pedigree that Angel was reciting before Oberlin, Harvard, Boulanger. Mm-hmm. Eastman, which Angel didn't mention, is mm-hmm. where he got a master's degree. That was in 33, and it was in 37 that he composed his one work with orchestra, the oratorio, The Ordering of Moses.
Do you know where that got performed or who commissioned
yes,
it or anything about it?
Yes, it's actually a notorious story that this was the Cincinnati Symphony, and it was being nationally broadcast, and the broadcast was terminated prematurely for reasons we can only guess at. But the likely reason is that listeners in the southern part of the United States objected, and without any reason given, the broadcast was prematurely terminated. And then many, many years
later. Let me think about this for a second. I worked in the radio business for a long time. In order for a listener in Mobile, Alabama, to know that a work by an African-American composer is going to be broadcast this coming Sunday, they'd have to be paying really, really close attention to something. Because you don't just turn on the radio and they say, oh.
Well, they heard it from the beginning. I'm sure that it was announced that this was an African-American composer.
So they started the performance and then stopped it in the middle of the performance?
The broadcast stopped. The performance
got it.
Continued.
I'm trying
but
to.
But it was no longer on national radio.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a startling but true story that this happened in the year 1937.
Okay. So was the piece performed ever again?
Cincinnati Symphony did it in 2016 and mm-hmm. recorded it, and it attracted a lot of attention then mm-hmm. and has ever since. It's been rediscovered.
I did a performance back in the spring with the Winter Park Bach Festival. Mm-hmm. It was my first introduction to that work, and it's such an incredible work, an epic work.
How big?
I would say it's probably 45 minutes long. My recollection
that's,
isn't
absolutely. That's serious concert length.
Yes, and Wagnerian proportions.
Uh-huh.
But at the end, the soprano and the tenor stand on the stage and they sing out above the orchestra. It has to be a really Wagnerian scaled soprano to cut through the way that it does it. It was one of the most thrilling things I've ever heard.
Kevin, I'd love to hear that. Can we hear a little bit of that music, do you think?
Could we hear the end of The Ordering of Moses? There's a wonderful high C at the end that the soprano sings, and it's Wagnerian in scale.
Let's have a listen. This is Jimmy Conlon, by the way, conducting a Carnegie Hall performance.
Thank you.
Well, that is stirring stuff. Make a joyful noise unto the Lord. And certainly that's what Nathaniel Dett did in that piece. Tell us again this piece.
The Ordering of Moses.
The Ordering of Moses.
It's an oratorio. Just beautiful piece. Powerful piece.
Yeah.
That was a recording on Bridge Records of a live performance at Carnegie Hall in 2014 with the Cincinnati Symphony, which revived this work after having given the premiere in 1937.
Who's the guy who wrote, I should know this inside out, the guy who wrote Afro-Americans?
Stills. William Grant Stills.
He was born
Still.
In the South, right? But he also went to Oberlin before he came to New York City. And I was interested that that's a long way in the United States, especially a long way in the late 19th century for a young black musician to go all the way to Oberlin or to go to Eastman. What was drawing them up? Who was going doing
Oberlin
recruiting?
Oberlin was very partial to educating African-Americans. It's part of their history. What's also very interesting is that both Price and Still studied with George Chadwick in Boston. And the reason that is interesting, and more than interesting, is that Chadwick and Dvorak were colleagues, and that Chadwick was greatly influenced by Dvorak to use Negro melodies. So again, the line to Dvorak is straight and clear, and all of these composers talk about Dvorak. We're now going to hear what may be Dett's best-known choral composition, Listen to the Lambs. This is about 7 minutes long. It's about the same length as O Holy God. Ankel, you've now had occasion to conduct this piece twice. When I first heard it, I was floored. Do you have any thoughts about Listen to the Lambs?
Well, I think it's phenomenal piece, in my opinion, too. It sounds very original. At the end, again, this idea of leaving for the end, the most dramatic part. Of course, there is this antiphonal ideas constantly. Yes, I think it's a very original and excellent piece.
We're moving along now to discover some more of these composers who seem to be fulfilling Dvorak's prophecy. Tell us about William Dawson.
The years are 1899 to 1990, which is a very long time. Imagine he's the same generation as Copland and Gershwin. Mm-hmm. And he's of particular interest to me because of the symphonies that I've heard by these black symphonists from the interwar period. I think his is of enormous importance. It's called the Negro Folk Symphony. It was premiered by Stokowski in 1934, and he thought enough of it to record it when he became the conductor much later of the American Symphony. And you must understand that Dawson considered it his symphony number one. He would have composed more symphonies, but his symphony so quickly was relegated to obscurity that he had no incentive to do so. As a result, we know him as an arranger of spirituals and an important arranger of spirituals. I'm going to ask Kevin to talk about what we're going to hear now, which is his arrangement of A Balm in Gilead. Kevin, what's the significance of this piece to you?
I think it's a beautiful arrangement. And like so many spirituals with chorus, he starts with the chorus. I think it's a solo tenor line. And then he fills in with the other sections of the chorus, the altos and basses and sopranos. And then in the middle of it, he has the baritone solo. It's just the perfect setting to me. And the thing is that I've actually sung it several times as just a solo piece at funerals because mm-hmm. people feel reassured by this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's of course comes out of the Songs of Sorrow, that tradition, but it's so simple and beautiful and hopeful. It's
exactly. Very optimistic in the, yes. at the end, absolutely.
That's right.
You're absolutely right.
There's a place that we'll go yep. that will be better. Yep. And I sang it at my mother's funeral and my dad's as well.
Could you say a few words about Leontine Price?
Leontine Price is one of the earliest musical influences in my life. I was very fortunate. I sang in the chapel choir at Fort Dix in New Jersey, and one of the alto singers in the chorus gave me this amazing new recording of Leontine Price singing Aida, and I didn't understand all of how Verdi wrote this piece or what inspired him, but all I knew from that point on was that I wanted to live in the world where that kind of beauty happens. And so that really actually made me choose to go to Juilliard because I knew that she had gone there for her education, and she has not ceased to inspire me since. I listened to her before performances, and it just inspires me.
But wasn't this one of her signature pieces?
She sang the spiritual, yes.
She sang A Balm in Gilead.
Yes, she sang A Balm in Gilead.
Right.
You know, along with a lot of spirituals, she recorded with the Rusk College Choir. It's not a recording that you see around very much. I don't know that it was a commercial hit. Mm-hmm. But Leontine sang with them, and it's, I would say, was recorded sometime in the mid-70s, maybe early 70s. I could hear this voice that could sing Aida also sing with absolute believability a spiritual that she sang from her soul.
So, Kevin, let's see how much of that inspiration from listening to Miss Price sing, how much of that rubbed off on you. Here is Kevin Days singing, There is a Balm in Gilead.
cannot sing like angels if you cannot preach like Paul. You can tell the love of Jesus and say he died for.
Kevin, I believe you when I hear you sing, man. You sound wonderful. For a man whose voice is way down at his boots, you have a beautiful, high, easy register when you get up there.
It is.
Thank you, Bill.
That could be a trick, though.
Yeah, it's not easy. I think there was a reason I had to study all those years to kind of find a way to sing as comfortably up there as possible. I would never compare my sound to the greatness of a Leontine Price. But I think the musical and vocal gesture that she
when
makes does influence.
You sing that top thing. It's always a surprise when you go up to the fourth. It comes a couple of times.
Yeah.
I think, man, that's in the stratosphere for a guy whose voice is so rich and deep. Beautifully sung.
Thank you.
And Angel, you had something to do with this too. Tell us.
Thank you. Yes, the Washington National Cathedral Chorus is, of course, a privilege, always working with them, and of course with Kevin.
So this was a setting by William Dawson, Baum and Gilead. Joe, what a show you brought us. How are we going to finish this?
Johann Sebastian Bach.
Yes.
I've heard of him.
So, you know, Burley's, one of his signature roles was Mendelssohn's Elijah. So we know that Burley knit together the spiritual repertoire and the classical Western repertoire. And it was our privilege to create with Kevin a program that would utilize him in Burley alongside Bach and Mendelssohn and Handel. So we're going to sample that by hearing, and this was actually Mike McCarthy's inspiration.
It's true.
Going from Were You There, arranged by Harry Burley, to the great bass aria in the St. Matthew Passion, Machadi. So why don't we just hear what that sounds like, those pieces in juxtaposition, for the first time.
All right, here we are. Once again, Kevin Days is our soloist.
Thank you. und trug ein Hymnblatt in dem Munde. O schöne Zeit, o Abendstunde, der Friedensschluss ist nun mit Gott gemacht, denn Jesus hat sein Kreuz vollbracht. Sein Leichnam kömmt zur Ruhe. Ach, liebe Seele, bitte du, geh, lasse dir den Toten Jesum schenken. O heilsames, o köstlich angedenken.
Lass Jesum ein, Welt gehorsam, lass Jesum ein.
Amazing music. Makadish from Matthew Passion of J.S. Bach, and the brainstorm, inspiration really, of putting that together with Henry Burley's Were You There When They Crucified My Lord was the gift of Mike McCarthy, who's the, give me his correct title.
Is the music director of the Washington National Cathedral Chorus.
Yeah, I think it's a marvelous stroke. Kevin Dace, the beautiful soloist in this music. And Joe, you're killing me with this music today.
With Angel Gil Ordonez conducting post-classical ensemble.
Right.
And now we close. I wanted to do a Bach concert with Kevin, and I wanted him to sing Ich habe genug. And I went to him and I said, we want you to sing Ich habe genug. And do you remember, Kevin, what you said to me when I said that to you?
I said something like, excellent, awesome, let's do it.
No. Oh. You said that in my entire repertoire is my favorite piece to sing.
It's true. Mm-hmm. It's one of Bach's great works. For baritone, he really gives such wonderful fluid lines for the bass to sing in that, the bass baritone. And the obbligato and the oboe is just a perfect mm-hmm. setting. And I first came across it, my dad, when he was stationed in Vietnam, he would send back reel-to-reel recordings. And I came across it listening to these stacks of classical recordings. It was his way of kind of his therapy for being in the war zone. And I heard this piece start, and I just thought, this is a wonder beyond my imagination.
Ich habe genug, I have had enough. What does that mean in this work?
It starts in C minor, and so there's this whole feeling of longing at the beginning. Yep. And it's based on the Songs of Simeon. So he is saying, before I die, mm-hmm. I want to see the Lord. Mm-hmm. And so after he does, it's in three major movements and a couple of recitatives. By the time he gets to the end of the piece, the third movement is, Ich freue mich auf meinen Tod. I'm actually happy that I saw this before I died. I saw the Christ child.
So we're going to hear this as performed at Dumbarton Church, which has a wonderful acoustic, and an all-Bach concert with post-classical ensemble conducted by Angel. We're going to hear the first movement.
Out of curiosity, I know the oboe part. Who was playing oboe for you?
Oh, yes. One of our extraordinary principals, Igor Leschizin, who is the principal of the Washington National Opera.
Let's let them go. Here's Kevin Dace, Ich habe genug.
Thank you.
What music, what a performance. Kevin Deiss singing Ich habe genug, the first movement of that wonderful cantata of J.S. Bach. Angel, tell me again the name of your marvelous oboist.
Igor Leschyshyn.
Yeah, spectacular music. What I love is that's sort of like Bach tells us the saddest story in the world and then brings in that little ritornello in the strings and solo oboe again.
Yes.
Almost as a way of consoling. It's still in C minor, but somehow says, like, hey, you know, it's going to be okay. In fact, ich habe genug, you've had enough, you're going to go to heaven. Beautiful. Wonderful performance. Joe, what a program, truly.
Do we feel purged?
I feel better.
I feel better, yeah.
I mean, like Bach knocks me out. It actually takes you dark and deep for a while. If you listen to what he's really doing, and the complications of his harmony and counterpoint are astonishing. Yeah. I love Mozart, I love me some Beethoven, I love me Bach. But yeah, there's something that Bach does, like any other composer.
No, that's true.
Yep.
Yeah. Thanks for playing that again. It's been years and years since I remember Dick Kilmer playing it with Tom Paul years ago in St. Paul. That was a pair. But you just topped that performance of anything.
Thank you very
Bravo,
much.
Kevin.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming to visit us.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to Post Classical on the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org. I'm Bill McLaughlin, and I have some of my favorite musical audio playmates here, starting with Joseph Horowitz. Great to see you, Joe. You bring such interesting insights, such interesting ideas, truly.
Bill, it's always a pleasure to be here.
And my colleague, wonderful conductor, we heard a lot of your work today, Maestro Angel Gil Ordóñez.
Thank you, Bill. It's always a treat being here.
Today, you brought this marvelous artist into the studio. So, Kevin Thays, it's a very great pleasure to meet you and hear you and have to come hear you live, man. It's wonderful.
Thanks for inviting me to the party.
Oh, man. Thanks for joining us at the party. Have a great time. We'll be back here sooner or later with Post Classical.
This webcast will close with a little more Bach as performed by Post Classical Ensemble, led by their music director Ángel Gil Ordóñez, the famous air on a G string, from Bach's Orchestral Suite No. 3. The next Post Classical comes your way Friday, April 5th. Our recording engineer in New York, Bill Zygmunt of Digital Island Studios. Check them out at digital-island-studios.com. Post Classical is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.